Nowadays, everybody's recording everything everywhere all the time, and whatever happens, there's usually video of it. Not just photographs, but video, you know. So there's no kind of guarantee of anonymity anymore, you know, in the city. And that's what the city used to represent, was the ability to be anonymous, you know, and not no one to know who you are.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today I'm joined by Greg Girard, a Canadian photographer who has spent much of his career shooting the urban landscape and people of Asia. He has authored several photographic books, including City of Darkness, Life in Kowloon Walled City, Phantom Shanghai, and most recently his upcoming book, Snack Sakura, exploring the iconic nighttime snack bars of Japan. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you out here in the studio in Kamakura. Indeed, I just picked you up from Kamakura train station just before, which is on the Tokyo Yokosuka line. And of course, your 2019 photo book was titled Tokyo Yokosuka 1976-1983. Here we are 40 years later, the same place, but a different time. Tell me about the first time you came out this way.
Well, the first time was 1976, and I had a ticket stopping everywhere from the west coast of the States to various places in Asia. So San Francisco, Los Angeles, Honolulu, Tokyo, Seoul, Taipei, Hong Kong, Bangkok, a one-way ticket on Korean Airlines. And I didn't plan to stay in Japan. I wanted to see it, though, because I'd heard about it from another young traveler on a previous trip who talked about Tokyo, and he talked about it in a way I'd never heard before. You know, this was before Tokyo was known as our near future, urban, Asian-influenced future that Blade Runner gave us and was later referenced in many ways in many places, but that was not really known in 1976. So I stopped in Tokyo, intending to stay a couple of days, rode the Yamanote line around Tokyo the first night, and got off in Shinjuku and walked around all night, liked it, and decided to stay. So,
wow. That Korean Airlines flight, how did that come about?
Well, back then, I guess, that was a typical kind of ticket you could buy, something that stopped everywhere. You know, and airlines used to do these kind of milk runs through whatever region, stopping everywhere. So rather than go nonstop, you could simply get off everywhere they stopped and serviced. And it was, I think something a lot of people did who were maybe taking some time off or were having that break year or whatever. So it was, a cheap and efficient way to see, in this case, Asia.
This is 1976. Had you traveled much before then?
The previous year, I'd been in Hong Kong and Southeast Asia, but not Japan. And I probably avoided Japan because in those days, and this is really, you can say, pre-bubble Tokyo. So it was before Japan was well known in those days as an expensive place, and that's no longer true, of course. But in those days, if you were a kind of a backpack level traveler, you might avoid some place that's expensive. And that was Japan's reputation in those days. But I wanted to see it, having talked to this young Australian guy who painted this picture of Tokyo that I'd never seen or heard of, the train conductors and their stylized gestures as the trains or subway trains depart, the mannered voices of elevator operators in department stores, you know, those kind of things that, unless you've been in Japan, you wouldn't notice or hear about, and that certainly hadn't percolated into popular culture, you know. So it was just on the hearing this story about what Tokyo was like that made me want to see it. And of course, it turned out to be exactly true. All of those things were the little not even nuanced, but the daily sort of features of life as you move around Tokyo, the kinds of things you run into.
It's two images come to mind. The first one is, of course, Wim Wenders, who we were just talking about before, who after Uzo Yasujiro died, he sort of came here and went on his own pilgrimage to sort of film and explore the work that Uzo had left behind with his film Tokyo Ga. And you could see in the film his fascination with things like the pachinko parlors and the minutiae of Japan in that period. I believe that was in the 80s. And then the other one that comes to mind is Andrei Tarkovsky, the great Soviet filmmaker, with Solaris, this sci-fi future, this kind of deep philosophical space film that features these images of the Tokyo highways as in lieu of a futuristic world. And I believe they somehow managed to get here from the Soviet Union to film that. And these two images of kind of an unknown universe of what lies in Japan, I can sort of, especially pre-internet, you know, the allure of that must have been quite profound.
And of course, Chris Marker as well, yes. Who I wasn't aware of at the time, you know. I mean, there really wasn't anything to prepare you for modern Japan in those days, unless you maybe look at the kind of almost camp version of it in something like the James Bond film that was made here. I think it was You Only Live Twice, and that was, I think, 1967. So, you know, it's this Japan viewed through the lens of the kind of the campy fantasy of James Bond in the late 60s. And so there just weren't versions of modern Japan floating around. I mean, if you wanted to see Japan, you'd have to see Japanese movies. And commercial Japanese movies aren't the ones making it into art houses in the West. You know, it's going to be Ozu, Kurosawa, people like that. And a lot of that work was already quite dated, you know, 50s, 60s maybe. You know, so you're just not seeing contemporary Japan unless you get on a plane and go there.
So going back a little bit then to your background in Canada, could you tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
I grew up just outside of Vancouver, neighboring city, a suburb really. And, you know, from the age of about 15, 16, started taking pictures downtown Vancouver. And in those days, it was a big trip for a young person going from the suburbs to the city. Vancouver was a small city and is a small city, but if you are from the suburbs, it was the only city you're going to know about. And so I started making pictures downtown of the people who lived, you know, in the kind of a rougher, more blue-collar, you know, port town kind of environment. You know, the kind of place that your parents told you to stay away from, basically. And, you know, in those days, Vancouver's relationship with the surrounding landscape and environment, so the mountains and the ocean, that was the economy of the city in those days, you know, lumber, fishing, a big port for shipment and transshipment to Asia. Mm-hmm. You know, subsequently, it's become a global real estate destination, mm-hmm. like so many attractive cities. But in those days, it was a small place nobody had ever heard of.
Yeah, it's interesting. The reason I ask that is reflecting on my own background. As I mentioned before, I'm from a small town called Hastings in New Zealand on the East Coast. And it's a farming town. It's on the Herotonga Plains. There's this kind of broad expanse of farmland and apples and dry stock and this kind of classic agrarian story. And for me, coming to Tokyo, to a city that is just concrete and skyscrapers and endless people and civilization, it was quite a shock. And I just wonder whether that background for you in growing up in the suburbs of Vancouver, if that maybe gave you a different lens to the way you saw somewhere like Hong Kong or Tokyo the first time.
I don't know. I mean, I liked it from the get-go. I didn't even hardly think about it. You know, when you're attracted to something, you just like it and don't necessarily reflect on the whys of it. And that's maybe even still the case. So I liked that kind of sense of adventure, you know, the sense of possibility that cities have. And in the 70s, Hong Kong was a much more vertical city than Tokyo. Tokyo was a low-rise city until quite recently. In the 70s, there was really just a couple clusters of high-rise buildings. The West Shinjuku Towers, the skyscrapers there, which were new, and then the Hibiya, Ginza, Yurakucho area in Tokyo, the business district, those were the only towers. The rest of the city was flat.
That's a good point. I mean, it is not so much a vertical city as it sprawls out. And in a sense, here we are 1 hour south, and we are still effectively within that kind of Tokyo zone in a philosophical sense. You know, we can take the train, the Tokyo-Yokosuka line, to get to Tokyo. And so, yeah, you're right. There is this kind of concrete, sprawling concrete that has sort of come all the way to the coast here, in contrast to Hong Kong, which is sort of, there's ragged island, and these skyscrapers sort of jutting out from it into the sky, right? So there's sort of a different quality there, but still, either city, you're surrounded by people. And this is maybe, for me certainly, this wasn't the case growing up, where, you know, you'll be lucky if you see anybody driving the other way. And I just wonder, my image of Canada, perhaps maybe other parts of Canada, more so than Vancouver, is of vast distances and things being spread out.
Yeah, I guess, you know, maybe Vancouver is a little bit of an exception in the sense that it, you know, it faces the Pacific, and it's been made by people coming into it from other places, like most of coastal North America, you know. So it has that sort of outward-facing thing going on, like a lot of port cities do, and, you know, to its benefit, I think. But I think you're right. If you travel not far in the other direction, or, you know, inland, you run into flatness and space and suburbs and boredom, basically.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned port cities, because, again, before we were mentioning, I mean, I'm from Hastings, but I spent most of my time in Wellington, which is a port city. Tokyo and Yokosuka are also port cities. Vancouver, Hong Kong, these places, there's a sense of liminality, people coming and going, whether it's the airports or the seaports, there's this kind of transience. And certainly a lot of your photographs explore the docks and the ships, but also airports, places like Kai Tak, the old Hong Kong airport. Tell me more about that sort of liminality of these transient spaces.
Well, I think, you know, if you want to travel, these are the gateways, you know, and it used to be ports before mass consumer air travel, and now it's airports. So those are the places that are going to take you from where you want to get away from, you know. And so there are these portals that I think are, you know, they have this charge to them, for me anyway, is just this sense of possibility. And, you know, I wanted to photograph it without intellectualizing it. It's just really simple attraction. You know, they've always been good to me. You know what I mean? I mean, they've delivered me where I want to go. And so, you know, just that sense of adventure that they open up. You know, I can understand that they can get routine if you're flying between, you know, Los Angeles and Chicago, or, you know, Chicago and Toledo. You know, I mean, if you're doing business and you're just trying to get through your day, airports are just something to be gotten through. But if you're traveling because you want to leave home or explore or whatever, there are these openings to new worlds, you know. And so they have that charge to them. Kai Tak is a very special example. It was one of the last of Asia's almost downtown airports, you know. I mean, a lot of these airports in their early versions, they started very close to the city, and planes were smaller and slower. And getting to the airport back then might have seemed like a long trip, but comparatively it wasn't. It was before they started building airports on the edges of cities to accommodate this huge transformation in air travel. So Kai Tak was like that. And in fact, the the runway stuck out into the harbor, creating this very unique approach imperative to the airport, where you had to fly straight towards a mountain with a big checkerboard, orange and white on it, make a hard right turn at around 500 feet, and you level out about 200 feet over very dense urban area and then on the runway. And so that was a very special thing. If you're living in Hong Kong, it's just the airport. It's just an ordinary thing. But if you've, you know, traveled a little bit, you know how unique it is. And so I always thought it was kind of extraordinary to have this thing on the edge of the city. And especially as I started photographing the Kowloon Walled City, which was nearby, I started spending a lot of time in that area near the end of the runway at Kai Tak, and decided to kind of photograph that as well. And, you know, it's like one of those things that's right in front of you and it's been there forever. You kind of think, well, I can do this tomorrow or next week, and there's no sense of urgency about it. But since I was already photographing the walled city nearby, I started taking a break from that and started looking at the airport a little bit, not with any ambition or anything, but just I thought it was fascinating. And it's like so many things, you know, you don't value it until it's gone. And once the termination date was applied, you know, they're going to build a new airport and the last days of Kai Tak are on the horizon, then people started noticing it and making these kind of personal pilgrimages to say goodbye to it. So by the last day, there was thousands of people around the airport photographing the last planes as they arrive.
Well, there's some profound imagery associated with Kai Tak and my own relationship to that place, because I believe it was 1998 that it closed, and this was around about the time that the handover happened from...
Yeah, a year later.
Yeah, you know, from Britain to China. And so there was a lot of things bound up in that kind of closure of the airport, I think, metaphorically. And we see this referenced in film, directors like Wong Kar-wai, who explored this imagery of airplanes and travel and this idea of an escape or the kind of the imagery associated with that. And so my own relationship to it was probably about 2018, actually sneaking in, I guess you could say, to the old runway, which was under construction. They're turning it into a conference center, a ferry terminal. And there's just one building left, which is the old fire station, where I guess the trucks would be parked for if there was an emergency. And it was still standing at that time. And I managed to get in there with a friend and explore it. And it was this kind of profound emptiness, because you've got this dark stretch of runway stretching out into the harbour of Hong Kong. Everything else is lit up around it. And sitting on that, on kind of the edge of the runway and looking out over that ocean was quite a profound moment for me. And kind of, again, this theme of connecting the past and the present sort of really came through there. And then today, you know, I went back a couple of months ago, and now it has been completely transformed. All of that stuff is gone. But it's sort of the closure of one portal and maybe perhaps the opening of another one, in a sense, right? So, I mean, Hong Kong, very fascinating place. And again, Kowloon Walled City, which was, I believe, one of the most, if not the most, densely populated place on Earth at the time.
Yeah, it's funny. That statistic, I think, came after the demolition, when people looked at, people meaning urban planners or architects, looked at the statistics of what was there and how many people were there and what kind of space, and made that calculation. But during the time I was photographing there, it didn't register like that, the fact that it was like the most densely populated place on Earth, because it never felt crowded when you're walking around it in these alleys between buildings. And yet, you know, you're above you is a very dense living situation.
I think something you mentioned earlier as well about not intellectualizing the process or the thought around these things. I think I understand what you mean. The desire to talk about it, I guess, can often get in the way of actually going and taking the photo and doing the thing right.
God forbid.
Yeah, and I sort of see this, you know, I'm sort of in the middle a little bit, where I do enjoy looking at the trends. I enjoy seeing, you know, where things are going, because certainly things have changed. But there is a fundamental practice that you must undertake, which is to put foot in front of foot and take the photo right. And I'm kind of coming back to that. I mean, what has been your approach? You photograph cities and people. You've got this incredible body of work. What is your approach to going out into the world and trying to capture it?
Well, it's sort of as basic as it can get, I guess. I think it's curiosity.
Curiosity, yeah.
I mean, I think I just want to see what's out there. And, you know, maybe a sense of, like, I won't sleep well until I do. You know what I mean? I mean, you've got to kind of scratch that itch a little bit, I suppose.
Scratch the itch. I think I understand. There's knowing that there's something around the corner. There's something out there that is waiting, and perhaps it's waiting just for you. There's moments that happen, right? That if you're 5 seconds earlier, 5 minutes later, you're not going to see that thing happen, right?
Yeah, I have to say I don't think about it in terms of missing something, you know, because there'll be something else. So I don't worry about it. It's more like you need that thing out there to match that thing in here, you know. So it's sort of like joining those two things, you know, however you feel about things or think about things. For me, they're not completed until I can, in the case of photography, make a picture about it. You know, I mean, I don't think it's a whole lot different than writing about it, painting about it. I'd say filmmaking is maybe a little bit different in the sense that it's a bit more collaborative. Usually, it doesn't need to be, I guess. But, you know, photography is pretty basic. You know, you pick up the camera and start making pictures. And, you know, you don't even need to leave your apartment if you're that kind of photographer, you know, in the sense of you can make a picture of anything. At some point, I need to go out into the world and sort of see what's there. And it's really just it kind of starts with that. So I don't go out looking really to tell a story about a city or a place. I've ended up there. I wanted to go there, and there's some level of fascination, for sure.
I think I understand. That's what we would say in media res. You're in the middle of the story. You must just go out and explore and try to frame it together. As you say, with filmmaking, you know, there's a plot and there's sort of storyboards and things like that. But with photography, you're sort of, it's real time, and you just see what happens. And there's a serendipity of it, which we both know what that feels like, which is quite profound. But I wanted to come back to this idea of the world, in the sense that things have changed. We were talking before about the way people see now has really changed, because everyone has a smartphone in their hand. And coming back to the 1970s, these trips into Asia and this unknown world, what was it like? The people you met, can you paint a picture sort of what you felt out here in terms of the way people approached living and the way they saw the world?
I mean, in one way, it's not different. It's like talking to a stranger. You know, the fact that we're connected to the internet and you go up to a stranger and you're talking to a stranger, I mean, it's all new, right? And it's all precarious and weird and interesting, and who knows where it can lead, right? You know, so it's really, yes, things are different, but no, things haven't changed also in that really fundamental way.
That's interesting. I mean, I feel, certainly I do get a sense when I look at your work that perhaps people back then, if someone was walking around with a camera in their hand, they would be seen as someone who is curious, someone who's doing something very interesting, and there was a kind of a palpable sense that it was fascinating, whereas today it's almost the opposite, where if you don't have a phone in your hand and you're sitting there staring out into space, that is the curiosity now. And I mean, I vaguely recall the period before smartphones myself, but certainly it has become ubiquitous. And no one, you know, and we just walked from Kamakura Station, saw 5,000 people almost, and, you know, there's this kind of great distraction in a sense. And
yeah, I mean, I don't worry about it or think about it too much. Okay. I mean, I think what's happened is that picture making has become a shared language in the same way reading and writing used to be the way we shared and communicated. And, you know, everybody can read and write, but not everybody's a writer, right? So everybody can photograph, but is everybody a photographer? I mean, I think it's very similar.
That's interesting. I mean, the other piece that, beyond the people, the other thing that just stands out to me is that this period in history, the difference in light. And today we have LEDs, we have, I think, fundamentally a different tonality, especially with nighttime. A lot of your work focuses on night. And it's almost impossible to show, because we've only got photos of it. We don't have the originals in the same way. But the colors of sodium vapor lights or the mercury arc lights over somewhere like Vancouver in the 1970s feels like it was a qualitatively different experience to what we have today. And I mean, is this something you've sort of found or you've noticed with light?
Well, the irony is maybe that, you know, when one started working for magazines, in my case, in the mid to late 80s, and let's say you have finally an assignment for a magazine, and let's say in this case it's for Fortune magazine, and all you've got to work with is like a fluorescent lit office to photograph somebody. You might like the way the film turns everything green, but your editor at Fortune is going to have a problem with that. And so you learn how to correct all these things that are now attractive, you know, like how to get rid of these casts that are now so atmospheric. I mean, I kind of like the way things looked a bit green, or very green even, you know, when I started shooting Kodachrome at night, or whatever film. And when you're finally given this opportunity to be published in a well-known magazine and start making even maybe a living from it, you know, you're tasked with trying to get rid of this cast. So you learn about magenta filters and how to put green on your flash to compensate, to match the, I mean, you know, you start getting into these technical things to make things look kind of normal.
It's interesting. I mean, the other classic example would be, of course, Hong Kong with its neon, which when I was there last time in Yau Ma Tei, it was a mission to find a single piece of neon light and a single piece of neon tubing still illuminated. Yet, back when you were first there, I mean, it was everywhere, and that profound quality of light you get from neon fundamentally impacted the way we imagine the city, right? It's historically seen as the city of neon lights, whereas that's no longer true. And I don't know, I find that very interesting how that has changed, right?
Yeah, and it's not just the quality of the light, it's like what it means.
Yeah.
You know, there it has this allure, this kind of attraction, this kind of maybe even a bit sort of noir, salacious, you know, promise of adult pleasure to neon. You know, if you're growing up as a kid, that's what it kind of represented, you know. And again, you know, when it's everywhere, no one pays attention to it. It's pretty much always like that. And it's only when things start to vanish that you start to value it.
It's interesting you mentioned the pleasures of the night, in a sense. And again, you know, walking down the streets of Yau Ma Tei, Shanghai Street, these different areas of Hong Kong, and you know, you've the market, the day markets have sort of closed up, so to speak, and the night market has opened, which is girls standing in the doorway. And the question earlier around the way smartphones and this kind of always seeing eye of mobile devices has come into the world, it seems as if it's harder, or it's a different approach to those things that once lived in the shadows. And you know, these girls are all on their phones, there's a connectivity there, and it seems as if once upon a time things could happen and no one would ever know in a place like that, whereas today there's, in a sense, there's always a possibility something's being recorded, that a text message is being sent. And I just wonder if you've reflected on that, the way we see things now, and the way we have a record of what happened and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's changed. I mean, you can't, there's no kind of guarantee of anonymity anymore, in the city. And that's what the city used to represent, was the ability to be anonymous, and no one to know who you are. And so the nature of being photographed has maybe changed a little bit. I think a good way to experience that is the difference in terms of the reception you'll get when you ask someone to take their picture with a phone compared to a camera. I think you'll find that people find it a little bit creepy with a phone, yet a camera kind of still somehow manages to separate it into a different kind of purpose, activity, meaning. Mm-hmm. It's considered less evidence, less invasive, less a violation of something, for how much longer that's going to continue, I don't know, but it still seems to be there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I know what you mean. I mean, even in my travels with huge tripod and lenses and cameras, there is a sense that there's some work being done. There's a project underway in a sense, but with these small squares of light that people sort of hold up and they don't even really look, they just sort of reflexively do it. It's this kind of a learned response that, oh, well, there's some food put in front of me and of course I'm going to take a photo of it. And this kind of overwhelming creation of these artifacts is quite interesting. And yet still, as you say, everyone can read and write, but not everyone is able to write a profound novel or a profound story. So there is still an interplay there where we're sort of drowning in images now, but still powerful ones come to the top.
It's funny. I mean, yes, we are. And yet that was also true in the sort of 70s and 80s. We were considered surrounded by images on billboards and television. So it's funny. I mean, that seems like such a innocent, almost frontier time compared to how we are both surrounded by them and making them in ways nobody really bargained for.
So I wanted to ask you as well, so again, you've got these profound images of cities and of cities under transformation. Your book, Phantom Shanghai, for example, showing the transformation of Shanghai over the years, is quite phenomenal. But then you've also got these studies of people. And I wanted to ask you, I was looking through your work just last night, and there's one image of a woman in particular, Keiko, the woman in the blue dress. You refer to her by these different names, sometimes by name, Keiko, sometimes as the woman in the blue dress, or sometimes just by the year, 1979, Yoyogi Park. Who was she?
Keiko was a friend, girlfriend, I guess you could say. I mean, how did people even stay in touch in those days? We had each other's phone number, I guess. I mean, I met her in the street and asked to take her picture, and we started spending time together. And it was exciting to, just meet somebody new and let's just walk around and take pictures, And so one day she turned up with, I think it was a pair of Charles Jourdan shoes, the French designer, and so it was an occasion, you know. And of course you can still do that, meet someone and go photographing. It's pretty exciting and interesting and fun, you know, to just make pictures of somebody new and lovely. And, we're both, early 20s?
Yeah, that's that idea of just meeting someone, though. Again, I do reflect on this moment we're in now. I was just before at the station while I was waiting for you, I was having a chat with somebody and, you know, I'm trying to put myself out there. But it does seem, people have retreated into the device. And so to be the one to, you know, strike up a conversation, it is, if it ever took courage, it takes courage now. And I find that quite interesting. And the profound people you can meet through simply saying hello. I reflect on maybe how that has changed. Certainly here in Asia, we don't maybe communicate in the same way, perhaps. But what do you think?
Well, I think it's what you want and how serious you are about it, and how to be at the same time light about what you're being serious about, so you don't, scare people.
Do you consider yourself a serious person, do you think, or more of a playful person?
I'm serious about the pictures I make. I try to be,
Yeah. It's interesting. You're working with magazines. You were sent on assignment to various places, and I see you were, in many cases you were there. June 1989, Tiananmen Square, Beijing, you were there.
Well, in fact, that was probably one of the worst decisions of my journalistic career. I'd been in Beijing for weeks before June 4th, the day of the killings. And I went there for a different reason. I think it was a business magazine assignment. And then the demonstration started happening, so I stayed on. And that went on for weeks and weeks as the students came out of the universities, went to the square, and as ordinary people came out of curiosity and or support. And there had been a first attempt to clear the square in May, and that was kind of stopped in its tracks by ordinary people who literally just stopped army trucks in the streets. They retreated, and then we're now up to about June 1st, and I decided, I'm going to go back to Hong Kong for a couple of days and kind of buy more film and maybe ship what I've got and, come back later. And then June 4th happened while I was in Hong Kong. So I went back the next day and into the aftermath of it, but I wasn't there for the night of the killings.
Yeah, that's interesting. Immediately, as if something happened off stage, you were there before and immediately after. But even that in itself, for me, this was before my time. It's fascinating to have a connection to these events, which have, they are incredibly important historical events, right? And to have a kind of tangible connection to that, I find very interesting. Because again, today, I feel like in a lot of cases we consume things secondhand, we delegate, but to actually have the firsthand experience of something, it can help round out maybe what is otherwise quite black and white opinions on things. These are the little moments, and you've got photographs of some of the students, some of the people there. You got one photograph of, I think, some soldiers reading a newspaper or being shown a newspaper. And these kinds of moments help flesh out the nuance of what is a complex story, right?
Yeah. The difference today is that you need less and less that kind of person from the outside to come parachuting in this case from the West into a non-West country to show what's going on to, let's call it, the folks back home, or other news consumers of a similar worldview. Nowadays, everybody's recording everything everywhere all the time, and whatever happens, there's usually video of it, not just photographs, but video, so these that way of looking at a situation and summing it up in a single picture maybe is becoming a little bit, I don't say irrelevant, but just disconnected. You know, it used to be that a photographer would try to understand a situation and make a picture, a still photograph, to convey what's going on. Now with video running nonstop, constantly, you know, is that skill, is that conceptual framework needed anymore?
It's interesting because when I look at your body of work, it strikes me that I wonder whether this is even possible anymore, that you can have these iconic images of whether it's the soldiers in Tiananmen Square reading the newspaper or the girl in the blue dress, these images that just that tell this profound story that's behind all of them. But today, you know, is it only ever going to be an imitation of an earlier time to try and do something like that and to, put on the green cast of the mercury lights, or to put on the grain of film and kind of to reproduce the kind of friction of the earlier days, in a sense, you know? Is it just make-believe?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, but I think it's curious how, like, nostalgia is so baked into so many things now. Like, I find it funny that digital cameras look like cameras from the 70s, you know, with the shutter rewind knobs, you know, as if they're actually doing something. I mean, I find that extraordinarily kind of odd, you know. So, you know, nostalgia is, it's seductive and it's attractive, but I think, you know, for me, I think it's a really dangerous path to go down in terms of self-consciously making things that reference the past like that. You know, I think when you're out in the world making pictures, you're looking for things that connect or don't connect, you know, little breaks in the scene in front of you, you know, things registering just a bit off, and then why is that, you know? With nostalgia, it's all there already. You're attracted to something from before, and either you make a picture that looks like that, and so I guess it's comforting, interesting if you've never been through it. But if, you know, I lived through the 70s, you know, 80s, like why would I make a picture that looks like the 70s or the 80s, you know? I mean, I don't need to, you know. Yeah. Having said that, as a young person, one of the things I first noticed when I went downtown Vancouver, in my case, was how certain places were locked in a completely different period of time. You know, you enter a pool hall, for example, and it's like you're in the 1950s. Like, nothing's changed. The way the guys are dressed and groomed, it's right out of the 1950s. And so, you know, as a young person, you know, that was attractive. Like this out of time place that you didn't know was there, and you've just kind of discovered it. And so, you know, that you're seeing this other world, and that was photographable, you know, before my time. So it was interesting, but I don't think I'd be making, a book today of places that I discovered that looked like the 1990s. Like, I can't even separate the 90s from the 2000s, you know what I mean? It's like, it's too late in my life. They blur together too much, and I wasn't paying attention to things in that way. As a young person, 1 year is a long time. So, like, the difference from the music from 1973 to 74 to 75, it's kind of etched on your young consciousness that you take into later life, you know? So I bear it within. I don't need to go back to it, you know?
Yeah, I think I understand. I think we're perhaps similar in that regard. I I mean, I am afflicted with the fatal illness of nostalgia myself. And I, again, growing up in rural New Zealand, which is just already 10 years behind everywhere else, and then, you know, it's at the bottom of the world, and you've got this this kind of longing for the past and the unchanging hills and landscape. I find coming to somewhere like Tokyo, which is always in this state of change, you know, there's always buildings getting put up and pulled down. That when first encountering that was quite profound. And coming back to the New Zealand case, it's also a very young country, so we don't have these ancient histories, and so there's this kind of temporal malaise that I always found myself in. And necessarily I started photographing things and trying to pull on threads, but as you say, I mean, to put it on and to make believe with it, it's perhaps coming from a genuine place, but it's not reflecting the truth that you know, something like the smell of cigarettes that was, you know, soon I vaguely recall in the 90s, you know, that was still a thing, but today no one smokes. You don't see that. And this pool hall you're describing, I can only imagine it smelled like cigarettes. And so no one's going to go and recreate that, you know. And there's sort of these other senses and these other pieces of it, right, that maybe don't come through.
Yeah. You know, I think what you're talking about maybe is just this personal world we carry around with us, you know, inside us, that everything is filtered through or can be filtered through as you look out into, like, the immensity of now, you know. Maybe you need that, otherwise it's just going to be too overwhelming or something, you know, I'm not sure. But Japan's quite an amazing place right now to be, because of its change, having lost the mantle of being our shared future. You know, this notion, which is kind of almost quaint now, that Japan would somehow be this futuristic place where we're all going to do what the Japanese have done in terms of technology and living and whatnot. It seems almost quaint now, but for a while that's what we all kind of thought, you know, when the yen was strong and Japan had this economic prowess that it no longer does, you know, and replaced somewhat by China today as the latest peer competitor, you know. And so going around Japan now, it's really quite unreal to go to these places, these smaller towns and cities where there's maybe no reason to go, and you see these places that have kind of topped out in the late 80s or early 90s and not changed much. I mean, there's a certain charm to it, but a kind of a sadness too, as young people have emptied out and no need to change the window display since 1993, kind of thing, you know. So a lot of these small towns in Japan are like that, and they're kind of mesmerizing, you know, this to time travel to these spots.
I know exactly what you mean. There's this old Akutagawa story, Rashomon, which is obviously the famous film, but the actual original Rashomon story is about this this kind of gate at the entrance to a city, and it's, you know, hundreds of years ago, but the city had fell on hard times, and there's this old woman who's living near the gate, and she's picking the hair out of the corpses to make wigs from, and this imagery of this woman picking the hair out of these corpses and to make wigs, and this kind of, I can visualize the candlelight and the kind of the cold winters and just this kind of austerity. And I'm kind of reminded of these kinds of images, right? There's a rural town in Yamanashi in the hills somewhere that is just shuttered, and there's kind of an old grandma sort of pottering around, and there's a sort of mono no aware is obviously the classic Japanese term for it. This pathos of being that it once was perhaps somewhere there could be a future that could be exciting, but now it's just sort of grey and ambling and perhaps a little bit cold. And this is a profound thing to kind of encounter, you know, this sort of feeling, this pathos of being, right? And I mean, it's something that's been talked about when it comes to Japan for many years. And perhaps maybe the bubble era was the exception. And in fact, we've got just this long history of that.
Yeah. You know, you have to kind of bear in mind just how out there Japan was in the late 80s and into the 90s before the things kind of flatlined. It was going to take over the world, you know.
Well, it's interesting you say that as well, because your other book, Phantom Shanghai, had a foreword by William Gibson, fellow Canadian sci-fi author, and certainly Neuromancer, arguably one of the first cyberpunk novels set in Japan, back in the 80s, I believe he wrote that. And that was, you know, talking about this future you describe of these huge Japanese corporations and virtual reality and cyberspace and all of these concepts that came through from that book. Yet it ended up, it was Shanghai that he wrote the foreword for in this case, which was, again, the changing of the guard in that sense of a future that was to come. In the case of Japan, it never really came, though. We never really got that, did we?
I don't think so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, certain things might have been, you know, shared across cultures for a while, but no. And you know, the reason, I mean, just to talk about William Gibson, you know, the reason I so wanted him to contribute to Phantom in Shanghai was to not have that book and how it's considered, the photographs in it, to not have them like go down memory lane, you know, to not be about nostalgia, to be about this future that is kind of rushing towards us, you know, and how Shanghai represented that in the case of Shanghai at the time. You know, you still had the massive landscape in Shanghai of the early 20th century city, still very much a feature of what Shanghai looked like. And again, Shanghai was very particular, though not unlike other cities where similar things happened. So think about Havana post 59 when Castro took over. Think about Berlin under Soviet occupation, where the capitalist grid gets separated from the place, you know. And so you have this modern city where there's no more building development for profit. So the state, in whatever capacity it has, will maintain it, but you're not going to have blocks pulled down to build skyscrapers and shopping centers and whatnot. So these places kind of start to age and weather. And you know, in the 80s, Asia was booming, you know, Manila, Kuala Lumpur, Taipei, Singapore, Hong Kong, of course, you know, everywhere in the region is urbanizing, going vertical. And Chinese cities are just flatlining because, you know, you're just coming out of the Cultural Revolution. Capitalism hasn't arrived. These factories from the United States and other Western countries aren't being built in the special economic zones. And so these cities are just kind of shells of what they used to be. And everything is being repurposed in ways never intended. Like a house built for one family now has 20 or 30 or 40 families living in it. So that was Shanghai, you know, post 49 up until the 80s. And, you know, Deng Xiaoping directed Shanghai to catch up. It had been actively held back for its role as a foreign place, a symbol of imperialism, basically. And so Shanghai did start catching up like gangbusters. And so they just started leveling whole neighborhoods. And that's when I moved to Shanghai, and that was going on. And so there's this, on one hand, you're kind of mourning the loss of this incredible period architecture, either Western Chinese or a combination of both in most cases. And there's a real sense of loss, but also this sense of oh my God, like what's going on here? Like, you know, I mean, you're having skyscrapers and demolition rubble, like almost in the same physical space, you know, this is kind of unreal. And so I really wanted that perspective of like this future rushing towards this place after having been denied it for so long.
I had never considered that. I think when I looked at those images, I was looking at the beautiful Art Deco communes and these lane houses that were getting demolished with this kind of ominous glow of the new city in the distance. But the way you've just described it, I mean, I think I understand now this future is bursting at the seams to come, and to and it's in a sense in the vein of modernity, right? It's coming, and you know, everyone needs to jump on board, right? And
that's or get out of the way.
Yeah, or get out of the way. And I think this now takes us to your current project, perhaps in a sense, with Snack Sakura, Greg, which these iconic establishments, which maybe we can talk about, the snack bars, because they represent, in a sense, both a place of refuge, a sort of a time slip where you can have a drink, a place to meditate on perhaps the past and the future. So what is a snack bar?
Well, a snack is a small drinking place that there really isn't an exact equivalent of it anywhere else. I mean, I think given all the choice you have in a place like Tokyo or any big Japanese city of where to go out for a drink, beautiful bars, restaurants, stylish, or even a kind of like the dive category that might, you know, linger and have a young customer base who likes that kind of thing. Snacks are kind of separate from all that. They're kind of, well, they used to be, and, you know, maybe that's changing, but I don't think so yet. But a snack, I think for most younger people, is considered like the most boring place to go for a drink, unless you want to sing karaoke. I mean, they're kind of a refuge for salarymen, guys to stop on their way home or go with co-workers after work. Interestingly, I discovered while working on this project, the category of a snack was invented as the Tokyo 1964 Olympics were approaching, and the authorities are worried about Westerners, foreigners being exposed to salacious Japanese nightlife, you know, clubs, sex industry sorts of things. And so to kind of control it somewhat, they decided to make all the bars and clubs close at midnight. But the bar owners got together and said, well, what if we're not exactly a bar? What if we have something to eat, some kind of food? Why don't we make this category called a snack? And we'll have like snacks like peanuts or oden or something to offer the customers. So this new category is dreamed up in order to stay open late. And interestingly enough, like snacks now are not open late. They close 11, 12, 1 maybe. You know, they're not late night places at all. They've just kind of, they've completely lost their fashionable luster. It was there for a while when they first appeared. And now, you know, I mean, they're places where middle-aged guys usually would go to drink. In most cases, in smaller towns and cities where there might not be the same choice, well, there won't be the same kind of choice of nightlife. There might actually be nothing else except a snack. And in these places, a snack functions more like a traditional pub where all ages might go there. But in bigger cities, they're mostly pretty simple. A bar, a counter with some seats, some stools, maybe a booth or two. They can also be more like hostess club kind of places where you'll have a menu system, you know, X thousand yen for an hour to sit and drink with somebody who's pouring your drinks for you. And you pay by the hour to sit and do that in those kind of places. But a snack traditionally is pretty simple. You pay for your drink plus some counter snacks, sit there as long as you want, have as much erythritol as you want to drink. But they're interesting for me because they kind of represented something not very fashionable. And I was doing another project, and I started noticing that every town seemed to have a place called Snack Sakura. So Sakura, cherry blossom, basically the most boring name for anything in Japan, right? You know, you see it everywhere. There's Sakura clinics, Sakura dry cleaners, Sakura car washes, you know, whatever. And, you know, quite nice Japan Airlines Sakura lounge, you know, if you're flying business class. So it's a common, hyper-common word. In Canada, for example, the equivalent might be Maple Leaf Pub, you know, like someplace you have no interest in going, right? So, but I started noticing as I went from town to town doing something else that every town seemed to have a place called Snack Sakura. So I started, I think I made one trip to just see if it was true. I didn't even do any research, and some places had them, some places didn't. But for the most part, I thought, yeah, this could be something. And then I checked with the All Japan Snack Owners Association to try to get some data about names. And it turned out that, yes, Snack Sakura was the most common name for their members. And so I just started going from town to town, looking for these places, started doing a little bit of research on looking on, you know, Google Earth, going through entertainment districts and looking up at the signage and, you know, internet searches. But not all these places have a web presence.
No.
You know, and if you maybe saw something on, you know, Google Maps or Google Earth, by the time you get there, the name might have changed or the building's gone. So you have to do, in my case, a combination of kind of, you know, research and just walking around.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. What I've found, having been in these kinds of institutions several times, I was struck, many of them don't have windows. Many of them are sort of hidden away, these sort of small, narrow spaces with maybe a couple of seats, if you're lucky. The iconic image of the mama-san, who sort of, maybe once upon a time it was different, but certainly nowadays, usually it is an older woman who's running the show.
That's right, yeah.
And the way you feel welcomed into it, because often, not always, but sometimes, you know, you will need someone to introduce you to it, or you'll need to kind of know that it's there. It's not necessarily well advertised, but once you're in that space, it's sort of its own little world, its own universe that extends from the back wall to the door at the front, and that's about it. And everything can happen, whether it's karaoke or deep philosophical conversations. And in a sense, the stereotypically cloistered Japanese persona kind of comes out, and people start talking with you, and many things can happen. And it's kind of, again, a little bit of a time slip as well, because often the furniture can be quite dated. You've got maybe some tape on the leather chair where it's splitting. You've got the smell of cigarettes just drenched into the wooden counter, and these kinds of visceral kind of sensory perceptions of the place kind of harkens back to an earlier era, right? So in that sense, it is a little bit of a time slip.
It can be. I mean, what I found was that most places had evolved, you know, over the years. It's now Snack Sakura. It might have been something else before. It could be something else later. And I actually found that any dated quality to the place was actually the exception.
Okay.
Rather than sort of the normal scene, because most of these places have gone through, you know, various iterations, and there tends not to be a lot of consideration about what goes into a snack in a lot of cases. I mean, a lot of them are just very basic, and no one has given a lot of thought to the design or the ambience, and you know. Considering that we're talking, you know, Japan, Tokyo, I mean, these sort of things can matter a lot and often do. You know, what kind of bar you're making has a huge impact on, you know, attracting clientele. But for the snacks, it's sort of a different purpose. You know, the etiquette in a snack, as you mentioned, you know, they tend to be small, and 99% of the cases, there's no window. That's kind of a feature of the stack. So you're in this enclosed space where you can't see into it or out of it. You open the door, usually a little bell dings. And the etiquette in a snack is not to walk in and just sit down, but it's a sort of a nod to the autonomy of the mama-san and her place that you ask to be basically invited in. You kind of present yourself at the door and ask to be invited to sit down. You can't just, shouldn't, I think, just walk in and sit down. That's really not how it's done. I mean, it's a way that signals the mama-san has the right to choose her customers, you know, and you're being invited into her space. Or there are men who run these places too. So that's the etiquette. You walk in and basically say, is it okay? Or pause, body language, is it okay? And the mama-san invites you to sit down and you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting as well. Not quite a snack, but certainly the Golden Guy district of Shinjuku, which you would be familiar with, in a sense has gone through this change where it has become, I mean, it is a tourist spot. It always kind of was in a sense, but now there is no locals there in a sense. And these places have had to either adapt or begin to work with that. But with the snacks in other parts of Japan, other parts of Tokyo, they can still be in their milieu. They can kind of hide away in between buildings, these narrow, often underground or deep inside a building somewhere, and they can kind of hide away from the changes happening in the rest of the city, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're likely to find a snack on the upper floors of entertainment buildings in any big Japanese city, as well as in the alleys where development might not have hit yet. You know, used to be around train stations, the back alleys around the stations had these drinking places, and I think all of Japan's nightlife kind of emanated from that.
From the train stations. Yeah. On your Instagram profile, you write, in the West, formerly in the East, and you're now living back in Canada. How do you reflect on all of these years in Asia? Questions of home, of belonging, what do you think about that?
Well, it's a luxury, isn't it, to be able to choose your home? I mean, what greater luxury is there, you know, than to be able to have a choice of where to live and go? And we're very lucky to be able to do that. So I just consider it an amazing situation to be in, to have a passport, sufficient funds to be able to at least get yourself to where you want to go and maybe stay. So, I mean, I never expected or cared about any formal sense of being accepted. I mean, what, you know, maybe just being ignored is enough. I mean, it's great, actually.
Yeah, understood. Well, look, it's been great to talk about your work, your history, your story, Greg. Very exciting time with your upcoming project. If you've got, have you got anywhere you would like to send listeners? Where would you like to point them to find out more about your work?
Oh, the easiest place, I guess, is Instagram, at Greg for a day. That's probably the go-to place.
Okay. And what does that mean, to be Greg for a day?
I don't know.
All right. That's Greg Gerard. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.